All right, I think we'll begin. I'm supposed to start with roll the tape, and we're now being recorded, so in conversation afterwards, just be mindful that you will be recording for other people to listen in the future. My name is Travis Houle, and I'm on Holton Village staff. I work with the utilities here, so sewer and water and electric. I'm also on the Science and Technology Advising Committee, and I also teach general science, biology, and geoscience to children in the Holton School. Tonight, we're going to talk about the science and ethics of mine remediation. The first half is going to be a really rapid presentation of a lot of scientific information and the process of the project. So if you have questions, please stop me, because otherwise I'll just keep talking and the jargon will pile up. At the end of that segment, then I'm going to invite you all to join me in conversation and talk about what we've just learned. Let's begin. So I want to start with a notion that I think is important when considering this entire project, is that the reason we are here in this village and the reason that Rio Tinto is here presently is because of this, which is copper. And whoever may be at fault in our opinions or in actuality, it all boils down to the fact that our society has a demand for copper. That we need it and we use it for war, for peace, for our infrastructure, whether it's electricity or water, modern technology, medical technology. It's an integral part of our society. It has been for a long time. Especially at the end of the 18th century, when James Henry Holden came prospecting up this valley looking for an ore body that he could develop into a mine. He was successful and brought down samples to Seattle. And in the subsequent years, they started doing development of the mine site up on Honeymoon Heights and at the main portal. It wasn't particularly profitable, and not until about 1928 when Howe Sound, which was a mining company out of British Columbia, took an interest in the site and started leasing it. Then the Depression hit. Copper prices were not particularly high, and not until things were getting ramped up for the wartime effort did operations as we know it begin. So they developed the main portal, they developed Holton Village and all the other infrastructure that was needed to have an intensive mining operation, and that mine ran for 20 years. Until in 1957, as the price of copper was plummeting, they closed. Then, as many of us know, in 1960, thanks to Wes Preeb, Howe Sound transferred the property and mineral rights to Luther Bible Institute. And in 1961, Holton Village was incorporated as a nonprofit. The first Forerunner Summer happened then, and the following year was when programming started to come underway.
Question in the back.
Yes.
Could we have some of the lights turned off?
Yes. I think it actually might be
those back.
Better? So, the mine produced quite a lot of ore, which on today's standards is not nearly what modern mines are producing, but at the time it was, I think, the second largest copper mine in the country. Over the 20 years, they produced 212 million pounds of copper, 40 million pounds of zinc, 2 million ounces of silver, and 600,000 ounces of gold. If you look at the gross revenue that they collected in 1957 at the end, they collected about $66 million. If you adjust that gross revenue for inflation, according to the Department of Labor, you get about $565 million, which is just a little bit over what the current tab is for this project. If you look at what the metal prices were from last week's stock exchange in the US, it's about $454 million for all of that copper, lower amounts for the zinc and silver, and the gold actually takes the cake. In total, if they were to sell all that 20 years worth of production in one day last week, they would have made $1.3 billion, which is a little more generous.
I heard at one time that there was still $1 million worth of gold in the tailings, but it would cost like $20 million to get it out or something like that.
Yeah, so there's several million dollars worth of various minerals in the tailings. And I think that was actually, after the mine closed, that was still something that was in consideration to reprocess that. So in terms of the waste from that production that we're familiar with, either in literary memoir or just looking at and walking over it, there was about 10 million tons, 8.5 was distributed across the site, 1.5 was backfilled into the mine as they were mining to create structural support as they were tunneling. There's 56 miles of tunnel and about 250,000 tons of unprocessed waste rock, which is what you see kind of between our water reservoir on the third level and our maintenance garage and where the second level buildings will be. That's the waste rock. A little bit about this, the reason that we have, that this process creates a lot of pollutants is because all of these natural occurring minerals and elements are kind of, they're trapped in the rock, and as you crush it and break it up, it allows those minerals to be pulled out by groundwater flow and by human contact, which is why we have a lot of this contamination. An interesting thing to note is that almost all of the contaminants on the site are actually naturally occurring contaminants that are just from this process and are not necessarily arsenic or other chemicals that were brought in the processing of those ores. So I'm going to go through the three main areas of contamination, and then I'll talk about the remedy. Groundwater has particularly low pH and a very high metals content. pH is the acidity of water or any sort of substrate. There's concentration of hazardous substances that exceed human health criteria. We can't drink the groundwater in a lot of the site. There's concentrations of hazardous substances in the groundwater and seeps that exceed levels that are protective of aquatic life, so macroinvertebrates, algae, some water plants, fish, and things like that. The specific contaminants of concern are aluminum and copper and lead and cadmium for human health, and then a couple others for ecological health. The process that is creating this is basically when you've got all this broken up mineral material that you introduce oxygen, it creates an oxidized byproduct from iron and sulfide minerals that then produces very acidic water called acid mine drainage. And you used to be able to see it pouring out of the main portal in some of the Honeymoon Heights seeps just going down the side. It really kind of is well known from this river. This is a picture of the Rio Tinto, which is what Rio Tinto gets its name from. It's a river in southern Spain that has had about 500 plus years of heavy mining, and the acid mine drainage has created a red-tinted water. This is a lot of data, but just on the left side, you can see various contaminants that would be in the groundwater. This figure is looking specifically at drinking water, so what our concern is as humans. And the shaded cells are the levels for those various contaminants that exceeded what was appropriate based on the EPA standard and the Washington State standard for safe levels in groundwater. You can see that not everywhere was contaminated in the site. It's a patchwork, and that pattern persists for contamination in all of the different areas that we're going to look at. In terms of surface water, it's actually very interesting. It met drinking water standards. So before the remediation project, you could go down and take a glass of water out of the creek and drink it, according to the EPA Clean Drinking Water Standards and the federal government's, and Washington State. Washington State's really strict on a lot of cleanup levels, so that's really interesting. That being said, there were concentrations of hazardous substances that were not good for the aquatic life, and one thing that you probably all know well is this reddish staining on the rocks. It's called ferricrete, and it's basically where a bunch of iron seeps out of the ground and creates a precipitate over these rocks. And what that does is it prevents a lot of small organisms that are the base of aquatic food chain to cling to that rock and use it as its habitat. So that's a really important feature of the cleanup site, is because it's not necessarily that there are lots of metals that are very, very toxic, though there are some. It's more so that this leaching iron is really becoming a problem for the aquatic life downstream, and that persists all the way down to Lucerne on some of those rocks. So in terms of human health, not a concern, except for the places where the groundwater is seeping in, so you know where the main portal might find its way down on high flow. But for ecological health, there were several contaminants of concern. And this is another graph, and I'll have them at the end of the presentation so we can reference them when we're chatting. In terms of soil, to me, this is the big one. This is the one where I feel, according to the data presented in the Record of Decision, which is the this document that is the mandate for the cleanup project from the federal government, that this one is kind of our biggest risk. And the remedy does a pretty good job of addressing that. So the concentration of hazardous substances in the tailings, waste rock, and soil around the site are a problem for not just aquatic life, but terrestrial life and us. Human health concerns, bigger list. It's easier for us to ingest or come into contact with those particular minerals in the soil. A lot of them, like lead and arsenic even, they don't transport through water very easily, but they do bind to soil very easily. In terms of ecological health, you can see that there's an even larger list, because there are smaller organisms like bacteria or mice or robins and things like that that are more sensitive to various minerals. The reason that soil, again, is a big issue is because of the Endangered Species Act and the concern for various protected species in the valley and just general life growing on the tailings. Although there were some plants, it was not nearly as hospitable, obviously, as the rest of the forest. Some ones to point out, the first five are on the endangered species list. Those have all been purported to be in the valley at some point in time, even the grizzly bear, which I didn't know before reading through the Record of Decision. Species of concern that were either delisted or are potential candidates for the Endangered Species Act, wolverine, bald eagle, northern goshawk, western gray squirrel, and then the bottom five are species that you wouldn't think you'd really care about, but the project did, and for some of them it's sort of optional. So like in the village, around here, the lead levels in the soil were not hazardous to human health, but they may be to voles or robins or grouse. So there was a potential thought of doing some sort of remedy in the village, but because it was not a major hazard to us, that was not mandated by the project. And then again, there's this very large chart with all of the figures. An important thing to note is that different parts of the site had much, much higher levels than other parts. So if you look, I like using lead because it's one people are familiar with. The east and west rock piles, 220 is the Washington State minimum for cleanup, and that's parts per million. So for every million molecules in the soil, there are 220 parts of lead. Just barely over the limit. If you go and look at the Honeymoon Heights waste rock piles, it's a lot higher. So when they say that they have to address a particular contaminant, it really does vary in the quantity and how bad it is for us. When you look at a cleanup site, there are different levels of contaminants, and this one did not have any major particulates of concern. So yeah, these are of concern, but there's some other minerals and things that are used, chemicals that are used in the processing of ore, that can be much more dangerous. So relatively, compared to some other major Superfund sites, this is not as bad, despite those levels. If you look at the site, it's, again, a lot to take in, but you have the tailings piles, which have soil contamination, you have the waste rock piles, Honeymoon Heights waste rock piles. Down here, going into the creek, you have seeps from those piles where water pours through, gathers some of those contaminants, seeps into the ground, and then comes back out into the creek. You obviously have the main portal, which is a big one. And then you have all of the water that's running over these things and is taking those contaminants into the creek or into the groundwater. The chronology of how this remediation came to be, actually I was reading, I don't know if it was in A Surprising Gift or another text, but I was reading that when the Science and Technology Committee was first formed in the late 60s or early 70s, they actually started considering how they would fix the tailings and the contamination. That was something they were thinking about. Like, we want to have a retreat center here, we're going to have people going over these things, we should understand it. That's one effort, but just over a long period of time, this valley is really interesting. It's a very, very remote valley with a massive cleanup site in it. So it's warranted a lot of research, and a lot of folks have come through to understand the contamination, the wildlife, and how those things interrelate. So in the late 80s, U.S. Forest Service started basically saying, we're going to do something about this. They identified a potentially responsible party, which would become Intalico, which would become Rio Tinto. So Intalico bought a company, bought a company, bought a company, bought House Sound. That's sort of how Rio Tinto inherited this. And then administrative order was signed by the federal government, and then they started really getting into, okay, how are we going to do the remediation? Not until 2007, when Intalico proposed sort of a permutation of the modern remediation, the technique we're using right now. And then after that, they started investigating whether or not that would work. And then 2011, they started the remediation project, really mobilizing. And this year, things are really winding down. Actually, I know they've said that before, but if you go to the 10-mile overlook, you can really see them capping everything and pulling the vehicles out. It's comforting. The general strategy was basically to cap, collect, and clean. To regrade and cap the tailings and waste rock, basically put new material on top so that soil can't go out. They wanted to, well, I'll talk about it more as we go forward, but they want to construct a barrier wall so you can catch all that groundwater that is toxic and filter it out. And they wanted to divert. There we go. All right, and they wanted to divert surface water that would be flowing over that contaminated area so it just glides over and doesn't catch those contaminants. And then, in the end, treat all that contaminated water down in the water treatment plant or adjust the pH, combine lime into the soil to try and fix it in situ or just at the site of contamination. So, if you remember tailings from before, very steep, very exposed. They did a major regrading of the creek. They basically lopped off this steep section, combined the material on top, and then thus reducing the grade, which dramatically reduces our risk in the event of an earthquake or a big spring runoff event. And then over top of this, they've put various different types of rock material to help in some cases absorb water, in a lot of other cases send the water just over it. They will be planting trees. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 70,000 plus next spring. So if it takes root, there will be a forest there. And then this is the Copper Creek diversion. So basically remade Copper Creek. So it goes over the tailings and doesn't seep into the tailings, thus transporting more of those contaminants around. And they've done these sorts of interceptor channels. This is Copper Creek, but they've also done it all around the site to capture that water and divert it into the creek. This is a map of the barrier wall, which is basically a concrete poured wall that goes from the surface all the way down to bedrock. It's a lot of concrete. I don't have the figure on how much, but it's a lot, more than you think. And it right now goes all the way around this section of the site and goes about halfway between TP2, tailings pile 2, and tailings pile 3. It collects the majority of the groundwater that's coming through and through a system of pipes brings it to the water treatment plant. This is not an image from up here. This is from a PowerPoint that Chuck Carpenter gave a couple years ago, but this is just a demonstration of what digging a barrier wall is like. You've got to trench all the way down to bedrock and inject the concrete in. You've got to make sure it's tight. If there's a leak, the federal government's coming for you, right? You need to make sure it's good. And as we know, they've done a good job. This is just from our site, this is just some of the scope of their bucket and their excavator and what they have to do and how far they have to reach. Then all that collected water goes to the water treatment plant. And this is not an image of the finished product, but I actually like it because it shows some of the process inside. Basically what it does is it takes lime and a couple other basic elements and combines it with this really acidic water that's coming through. Lime, which is from limestone, because it's really basic and acidic things often like to grab to one another. So what the lime does is it takes a lot of those heavy contaminants, it basically grabs onto it, and it prevents water from transporting it through the site. In some places on the site, like the Honeymoon Heights waste rock piles, which are difficult to get to and difficult to run a barrier wall or pipe from, they are going to be putting lime, just mixing it in with the soil. There's also some other remedies. So around our maintenance garage, I do rounds for the village some of the days in the week where we go and check the water plant. And one day I was going up there, and I was driving our 76 Suburban or 73 Suburban, and I come up and there's just a 10-foot deep hole all the way around the maintenance garage because there was diesel contaminants in the ground. And what they can do is take a lot of those contaminants, expose them to air and bacteria, and it starts to break them down. So they, in some places of the site, they've done that, where they've picked out this rock material, done sort of a just open air, give it some different microbes, and it does its trick, and then put it back on the ground, which is really remarkable. So among the many environmental benefits of the project, I think it's also important to understand the environmental costs. In a couple of places on the site, they had to do a pretty significant amount of habitat destruction in order to get rock material to put on top of the tailings and to do this project. Now, that being said, they're not transporting it from outside of the valley, so I understand the ethic. But this is a few images. This is one from the rock quarry, which is on the Monkey Bear Falls Trail. So if you're kind of between 10 Mile and 10 Mile Falls, where you cross on the road, and Monkey Bear Falls, where you cross on the road, it's right up there. And then this is the very nice view from the 10 Mile Falls Overlook. This is the avalanche chute just across from it, which they call the Borrow, where they have borrowed a lot of rock material, sifted through it, and that's what a lot of the capping material and the regrading material has been. And they are replanting that. But it's important to consider. The biggest one to me, in terms of environmental cost, is the amount of diesel that's consumed. So this is a table of gallons per day of diesel that Rio Tinto has given to us in various site coordination meetings over this time period. So our mine clerk was really gracious and gave this to me to do some calculations. So you can see that it really varies between 800, depending on ramping up the season where they don't have a lot of folks and not doing a lot, to 4,500, which is a lot of diesel. To put it in perspective, the village generally operates off of about 3,000 to 4,000 gallons of diesel in a winter. If you look at the low end, it's about 1,000 gallons per day, which, according to the EPA, equates to about, of diesel, equates to about 10 metric tons of CO2, so fossil fuel emissions that contribute to climate change. If you look at that for a season, we're looking at about 1,200 metric tons, or, to put it in perspective, the average American is responsible for 20 metric tons of emissions in a year. So that's everyone from the Al Gore big fossil fuel users down to the average Holdenite who doesn't use that much necessarily. over the course of, like, let's say, four intensive years of construction, 2012 to now, that's about 48,000 metric tons of CO2. The high end estimate from those numbers that we got from them is 4,500 gallons per day, 45 metric tons, or 5,400, 270 Americans' annual emissions, or over the course of the project, 21,600 metric tons of CO2. That doesn't include travel for their employees to come to and from here, and they did do a really quite a good job of trying to get local employment, a lot of their subcontractors and folks, and then fuel for mobilizing all of that equipment. In terms of future consumption, based on the energy estimates for the wastewater treatment plant down the road, they're looking at about 100 kilowatts to 190 kilowatts on really intensive days. That annually, for just base operation, is about 88,000 gallons of diesel, which is equivalent to about 895 metric tons of CO2, which is equivalent to about 45 Americans' annual emissions. Which is really interesting because you look back at this figure, it's not, I mean, it's significantly different, but it's not that far below what the low estimate is for a full year of operating here. That also includes, doesn't include 46 barge trips annually to get their lime and materials up and down. It doesn't include travel costs either for, in terms of emissions for their workers. I think another important environmental cost to consider is the interruption of our standard environmental practices in the village, which includes basically taking everything that we have and recycling it here, some waste going down the mountain, but in terms of composting and doing with our recycling plant, we haven't done hardly any composting here because the stuff that's in the kitchen has not been compostable with our system. It's a lot of meats and oils and greases. And we also have not done hardly any recycling with Rio Tinto. Us, the village, have tried to do that, but it's difficult when you pay it so much and you have to get work done, and you're working in a kitchen or you're working here in the village, and are you gonna go down and take the time to do carbon recycling or the other things when it's not necessary? And to sympathize with a lot of those kitchen workers, something to be understood there. In terms of the kitchen, like I said, and as you understand, there's a lot of meats, oils and greases, dairy products, things like that. That's really, really bad for our septic system. Really, really bad. Changes the chemistry in our septic tanks, and then that can clog up our drain field. And a drain field in this valley runs about $500,000. So, economics, right? But then you're also putting out not really high quality waste that is then seeping into the ground in our forest. And if we're doing it properly, it should be pretty high quality and feed the forest. In terms of renewable energy, right now we're not on hydro. We haven't been on hydro for a lot of the project because, again, understandably, they need to offer their employees a certain standard. So hot showers, being able to call their families. With our standard energy budget, we can't supply that. So they have diesel generators and they've been supplementing energy, and we need to do our own improvement projects at hydro that have then been on their diesel. We normally also don't use a whole lot of fuel, which they are using a lot of fuel. But I do think it's important to consider travel, because y'all came here from somewhere. And that is CO2 emissions, and that is energy that's being used. I don't necessarily know if them, who have the similar numbers to what we have in a standard summer, I don't know if that's different, really, than the standard emissions that we put out. I don't have any way of calculating that right now, so I can't really put teeth in that argument. Things we didn't consider, I just want to say about the diesel stuff too, I don't know if there's really a good alternative in terms of fuel that they could have used to do this project. It's a federally mandated project, and they're trying to be efficient with their costs. So understanding that if you're going to operate an Arctic in an excavator and you're going to bring a temporary generator up here, it's going to be on diesel. And that's kind of on the federal government for mandating them to do that. Granted, they definitely have some control over how much they're using, how efficient they are, but that's something to consider. Other thing I didn't cover is phase two, which is if this doesn't work, the remediation project is not successful and they are not don't meet the cleanup standards for the majority of the site, then there, according to the record of decision, is another phase of remediation that also includes heavy construction. That's after 5 years of monitoring. So as our friends come up and start putting in their wells, cross our fingers that the numbers come back great. We also didn't go over alternative remediation plans, which included things like taking all the tailings and dumping them in Lake Chelan, which actually, if you look at the alternative, wasn't that bad of an idea. Or taking them out to another place to be processed, sort of not in my backyard arguments. I didn't go into really the details of the specifics of the data, so by just how much certain areas of the site exceed health standards or ecological standards, and where. And I didn't go over the monetary surge that we've had from the rent checks from Rio that has been a major part of the funding of the capital projects in the village, including our fire protection system from forest fire that could be argued save the village. So all things considered, I have some thoughts for fodder to start our discussion. Do the net environmental benefits exceed the net environmental costs? So is this project better or worse for the environment? Who's at fault? Is it the federal government? Is it society at large who demands copper? Is it Rio Tinto or Italico who's inherited that particular company? What are the benefits and costs to Holden of this project? There are certainly a lot in terms of infrastructural improvements, but in terms of the interruption of our culture, I'm not sure. How will Holden be impacted in the future? We have a water treatment plant. We have people manning the water treatment plant. We have people bringing things up and down the road, like big giant tankers of lime, to operate the water treatment plant. There will be people here. And how will the amount of people and how will we relate to them? How will they benefit the community here or the valley in general? And lastly, should we have done it? Should it happen at all? Ground rules for the discussion. I would ask that we all behave in a civil manner so that we do not have some sort of confrontation, as is Elise in this picture on the first day of school. I would ask you to be mindful of how much you're talking and how largely your voice is weighing in to give some space for others. And I would ask you to really be courageous and speak your mind, because this is an issue that affects everyone in this valley and everyone in the Holden community, and it's important. I think the first question that I'd like to start with is, how should we tell the story? When we have official guest opening coming, or when I go over to the Holden School to do a science lesson with the kids, how should we tell the story?
I have a question. If Holden Village, the retreat center, had never been here, and it had remained an abandoned copper mining town and nobody was up here, would remediation still have had to happen?
Can't answer that. The record of decision in the intro does talk about the significance of having a lot of people coming through this valley and a lot more contact. I believe that the CERCLA cleanup standards and the agencies, which is basically just the Federal Government Forest Service, Washington State, things like that, they have a certain bar that needs to be met. And ideally, you'd want, you know, the entire nation to be cleaned up, right? But is that economically feasible? Is it logistically feasible? If we weren't here, would there be road access up here? Still. I don't know. Would there be a boat company up in the lake that has, you know, there's a lot of sort of what ifs. My hunch is maybe not, but that's my opinion.
One of the questions that I don't think you did address, unless I missed it, is $500 million, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
To, as I understand it, save some benthic community and so forth in the stream. How else could the $500 million, this is a big political question, you know, be spent in inner city schools or any number of social programs and so forth? Drug treatment, you name it, you know, I mean.
And that's
a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. And it's really interesting because originally, when they first declared this a cleanup site, it was going to be a Superfund site, which means that it's superfunded by a lot of different parties. This is not a Superfund site. This is just funded by Rio Tinto. Federal government's not dishing out any money for this.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So it's an intriguing thing to consider.
I assume that some of it was, yeah.
That being said, that's still a lot of money. And what could the uses have been? And the federal government's not using that money, but they're mandating the use of that money towards this particular environmental risk.
Yeah, I was a little bit off there, assuming. I knew it was Rio Tinto, but I didn't think that.
Yeah. But it's still, the ethical question stands. Is that a good use of money?
Yeah.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate. I've always said that long ago, they should have cleaned up what was coming out of the portal, which is the aluminum silicate. All this other stuff about worrying about slump and et cetera, for spending $500 million, I don't like it. If it would have been federal government money, as you were saying, I'd say it's crazy. Because you get very little benefit out of it. Yes, the fish, the trout could actually find food along the tailings, which now they can't, although upstream they're fine. It used to be they were downstream. You indicated it's gone downstream a bit, which I hadn't heard, in terms of whatever is keeping some of the crustaceans, the micro insects. Whatever.
Yeah, and there is some Fair Creek down, but you are right that there is stable populations of almost all aquatic animals and fish downstream from the site as well as upstream. Yeah, so, I overlooked that in my presentation. It's important.
So I always thought overall it was a lot of money. And the estimate, actually, just so you all know, for Rio Tinto was this was going to be like $200, $220 million or whatever. And after 2 years, they were way behind on getting it done, and they were running over budget, and to be fair, they budgeted a heck of a lot of money to get it done in one more year. The fire prevented that, so it's extended into this year. So I think they've done a good job on keeping up their end, and it was paid for by their insurance, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Yep. One of the things to be said, too, is that Rio Tinto never had anything to do with the actual mine itself. This was an inherited problem.
Yeah, and that is interesting, too, because why should they necessarily have to flip the bill for it? If they're, and people might argue back and talk about other Rio Tinto sites, but really, I think you sort of need to focus on this one. Why are they the ones that are responsible for it? Yeah?
Well, I just want to make a point about, this is Dan from Falconer, that I don't know how to answer that one directly, but I think that's actually one of the most important things about Superfund site law, which I know technically doesn't count here, but the mining industry for years and years and years handled this by creating subsidiary companies that would do the mining, and then close the mine, and then go bankrupt, and all the costs were put on society. And that was a pattern years and years and years. What the Superfund law said was, you buy the assets of another company, you also buy the liabilities. And that's been incredibly important for actually getting some cleanup done. And while the Holden mine is a much larger scale one, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of mine waste, mine sites in the West that are not being cleaned up, that are still leaking in the environment. So, one of the things that's really important for me is I think that this, a project like this gives us a real tangible estimate of the true cost of mining. That we had a pattern of privatizing the profits and socializing the costs of mining. Mm-hmm. And so society and the environment have always had to bear the cost, and there's still billions of dollars in costs that aren't being addressed. So, you know, I think one thing that's really important is we get some sense about what the true costs of mining are, what the true costs of our consumptive lifestyle are, when you have to begin contemplating the actual cleanup that usually just gets externalized onto society and the environment.
Hey, John?
Kind of a question, but along the same lines of inheriting others' problems, Holden Village was originally considered one of the responsible parties for this as well. So we we kind of had the rose pinned to us as well. Is that correct? Or?
Yeah, we own the mineral rights. We don't own the land that the tailings are on. That's Forest Service land, but we own the mineral rights for the land, or for the mine portal itself and the ore body.
You mentioned that there's some things in the village proper that, so even though this is leased land from the Forest Service,
yep.
I'm just curious, in your study of the Rotha, what do you see there as an ethical dilemma for us?
I think that really Holden's kind of been opted out of their responsibility for this. One, probably just because, imagine asking Holden Village to pay for this project, or conduct this project. That's a major undertaking. And two, did we really know what we were getting into? I feel like that's something that's, you know, reasonable to consider. But yeah, I don't know the answer to that, John. I feel like there's still, I know that the liability is not on us at this point, but it could have been. Why it's not?
Are there other options besides using that much diesel as far as the cost benefit ratio long term?
I don't know. I don't know. Does anyone else have a?
Could you repeat the question?
Are there any other options besides using that diesel?
Like hydroelectricity.
Well, so yeah, there is a potential to do hydroelectricity on Railroad Creek. In the past, actually, Holden Village did propose to put a hydroelectric facility on Railroad Creek, and I think they had a permit for it in '83. We just didn't have the money or wanted to expand our power options. But there's precedent for that. I don't know if Rio Tinto is considering that. I would assume so, but I'm not sure. I can't speak for them.
Isn't Rio Tinto going to have a film on this that does give them a PR as a consideration for other mining companies to keep mining, shall we say?
Yep.
That this is a model for, yes, we miners are good, you know, good about taking care of things. Isn't there an upcoming?
I would assume that they're going to do something like that. I'm not entirely positive.
I think I heard that, but.
But it is, I mean, it, yeah, it's.
So PR is.
I would assume that part of this project is definitely PR. And it, I mean, it is. They're cleaning up a mine site. Whatever we might feel about it, they are doing a remediation project here. I know, maybe Dan, you can speak to this a little bit more, because you probably have deeper roots in understanding mining sites, but I know that a lot of new mining sites are being examined with a much more stringent regulatory microscope or magnifying glass. So in my own home state, Minnesota, for a long time they've been proposing to put in a rare metals mine sort of alongside the Boundary Waters watershed outside of Duluth. And that's been a major point of political contention because they want to make sure that while they're mining, they've got some sort of capture and clean process that's not letting a lot of the problems that are associated with intensive mining pour into the Boundary Waters. I know someone made a fair point today at a meal that, you know, these are the costs of coming back to this site and cleaning it up. What are the costs as you go along? I mean, if you were to take just their gross revenue, right, and adjust it with inflation, well, this is a wash to me in terms of how much they're spending on it now. But if you're cleaning up as you go, but then can you actually clean up? Who's examining that? Are the regulatory agencies being strict enough, or should they? I mean, those are questions, right?
Well, I'm Jeff, I'm the local brigade chief. I think the difference is, culturally, there was a time when we accepted responsibility getting dumped on the local folks and communities. Now they have the corporations and whoever's doing the mining realize they're going to have to clean it up. So it's not just a matter of cleaning it up as you go, it's a matter of designing controls and things to limit the amount you have to clean up and maintain essentially control of your waste and stuff, instead of being under the belief that you can just dump it and walk away.
When you go on a hike on the other side, it used to be that at the top of the tailing piles, there were rows of old used refrigerators. There was cables thrown down off the side. There's a frame of a major building standing up there yet. What's happening with that stuff? Is that being cleaned up also?
Yeah, so that, and that is one thing that I sort of glossed over in the presentation. So the mill structure and a lot of the other buildings and structures on the site were removed. The mill structure was frankly quite dangerous. Just a lot of stuff that hadn't been maintained, that big steel beams and things that could fall down. Then a lot of the other trash and waste on the project, they've had to move out because of the capping. Now, I don't know exactly how much of that stuff has been landfilled somewhere on the tailings or taken out of the valley. I don't know the answer to that because it's not in here and I haven't been around since this happened.
Yeah, I mean, basically, my understanding was that Rio Tinto took everything off the tailings in terms of what we didn't normally recycle and get out of here. So the refrigerators and all the stuff you're used to went out a couple of years ago.
There was one other sobering thought about the hydroelectric. We've been really hoping that we would have, that Rio would put in a hydroelectric so Holden could have a little more power too. But the sobering long-term thought is, are we still going to have glaciers, and are we still going to have the everlasting electric, the hydropower to power another electric hydro?
Which is, yeah, and that's an interesting point. I also have the pleasure of doing the weather here some of the days, and I've been looking through the weather data, and there was a statistician who was in the village, and she really liked doing statistics, and she looked at all the different weather trends and what correlated most to our power availability in the wintertime. And interestingly, the only thing that was strongly correlated was fall rain. So when you think about it, right, Copper Basin, where we get our water from, that's a very large area. There's a lot of different geologic layers. Potentially, and knowingly, there is some aquifer potential up there for rain to be held in and then slowly siphon out. Now, to what extent there will be a statistical anomaly when you don't have a glacier on the side of Ferno and Copper, that's an interesting notion. But it is, even with that, you start getting this sort of, it's a mixed bag.
You mentioned there was a couple different alternatives to the remediation that they did, and one of them was to take the tailings down and dump them in Lake Chelan, and you said that might not have been that bad idea, but that sounds like it would be, I mean, if the tailings were what was killing a lot of the life here, it seems like that would have been a terrible idea.
Yeah, so right now, a lot of the minerals being introduced as a pollutant is because there is oxygen and aeration that's being introduced into the rock. So if you take that rock and you bury it below sea level at the bottom of Lake Chelan, you put it in a reduced environment, which means that there is not a whole lot of oxygen to bind to those particular contaminants. And so the notion was, we could take this stuff and dump it in the bottom of the lake, and if you do it in a way that doesn't spread it all over the lake, bring it down to the bottom, then a lot of the process for contamination is not there. Now, that was even a consideration when they were first generating the tailings, was to just, I don't know if you've ever been to any of Linda Jensen's really wonderful mine history talks, but she talks about some of the alternatives that they wanted to do with the tailings, and they had mentioned bringing it down and dumping it in the lake early on as a solution of getting out of the valley. Someone was thinking about that. But I'm assuming, I haven't read through all of those alternatives in the details, but I'm assuming that a large part of that was, can you imagine the Chelan community, what they would say in response to dumping them all in the bottom of the lake? I mean,
I want to speak to two things. My name is Diane, and I was here and in a serious part of the negotiations from 2000 to 2005. And so I know a couple of things about the PRP status, which was that at that time when they reached some of those decisions in your history, One of our key roles where we had some power to influence all of this was that we were the local impacted community. And so in terms of testimony, and some of you were part of a kind of an informal network of please write to your legislators, et cetera, as things started to unroll, the issue of how long the village would have to be closed was that was the thing that we in those years were extremely concerned about in terms of long-term impact. And at that point, things changed, as they changed before me, because this went through many, many director periods. We agreed to 2 years max would be what our part of our contribution would be in terms of a cooperative work closure, all of the things that were necessary. It is not as though we have not contributed significantly to this whole process. The other thing that happened in that process is that this is the fourth mining company that owns this. And Rio Tinto came along after I left, but Intelco and the French company were during my era. And both of those companies were represented by the same attorney who said that if the option that was really on the table and being discussed was $32 million at that time. And he said, if this goes over $50 million in terms of what is insisted on, we will go to court and protest. That's our bottom line in terms of how far we would go, because we think the cost-benefit analysis is such that we would win. And it was lots of environmental studies. So I'm not exactly sure what all happened. Clearly, a different attorney. As it moved toward Rio Tinto. And that's kind of the last thing that I would want to comment on in relation to how we should tell the story, is one of the things that I learned was how much personalities that were involved led things in the direction that this went. When you started thinking about government agencies, where you said the federal government or the mining company, was very much a factor of who was the voice at the table at different times representing what particular agency and their own attitude to the severity of the issue and whether or not the bottom, you know, the, all of these other things that you've so beautifully brought out were even to be part of it. Picture of consideration. There's a whole very personal factor in all of this that really changed significantly over the entire period of time, including on the mining side. So I think how we should tell the story is really in light of the way you've presented this, which is that it's very complicated. And there's not just good guys and bad guys. And we had an environmental ethics class here from PLU in the middle of all of this, and they used the mine as their project. There were 16 alternative solutions on the table, and they were in teams, they examined every solution, etc. And many of these students were strong environmental advocates. And then they had to come together and have conflicted conversation about what they would recommend to our board, as if the board was making the decision. And they came out of that agreeing with exactly what you were saying, that the water out of the portal needed to be treated, that there should not be a barrier wall that would be built, a whole lot of things that clearly had resulted in their own thought that the perfect environmental absolute cleanup was probably not, in the overall scheme of things, the best way to go, because they're looking at all the really bigger issues. So much has happened since then, but I appreciated that it was complex, it's still complex, and that's the only way to tell it.
Maybe a couple more.
With the question of whether the project should have happened at all, I think one of the main considerations has to be that you took a local environmental issue and added to our main global environmental issue. And if this project has set a precedent for what other remediation projects will be in the future, what is that going to mean for adding CO2 to the atmosphere and affecting the entire planet?
Important point.
You started your talk by showing the copper and that we all use it, and someplace along the line you made some little joke about Al Gore and said something about, of course we're not like that, but we are, and it's our footprint, carbon and otherwise, that drive, you know, the needs for these things, and eventually the resultant pollution and so forth. Not that there aren't better methods of doing these things, and this will force some of it, but I don't think we can avoid, you know, we as Americans consume what, like 25 times the average African and even 3 or 4 or 5 times the average European. So gotta look in the mirror.
Yeah. That's also a very important point, and I think I've, you know, came from Minnesota on a train, flew home to see my girlfriend, flew back.
I've probably got a bigger than average even American.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have calculated, and mine's bigger. But I seem to value that coming to Holden is a environmental lesson that, in the long run, may trump that. I think that's a big question for the village community in general, right? Is how do we, if we value our carbon footprint, our relationship to the broader global issue, what are we going to do about it? Are we doing carbon offsets, or, you know, I don't know. That's a fair question that we can answer in this room.
Good question. Al Gore wrote a book that got a lot of people's attention.
Yeah.
What offset does he get for that?
No, definitely.
I mean, you can go on and on and on.
Yeah.
You said that it's 45 people's worth of CO2. We have more than 45 people living in Holden every year, not using very, or hopefully our footprint is smaller while we're here, unless we're flying home every time.
That's an interesting question. Maybe we ought to do a calculation of the village. I have no idea, but yeah. I'll take maybe just two more.
Yeah. To piggyback to the environmental impact, the reason we even are talking about mine remediation, because it was in our backyard, and we're still buying cheap copper. So this backyard is now in a third world country, and I'm sure they're doing it in the same way they did 100 years ago there.
For a lot.
The thing that is affecting us is the CO2 comes and bites us in the butt, and now we care. Just like the tailings were affecting us locally, and we cared. So it's kind of the big equalizer.
Just one more.
I look forward to another kind of storytelling about this project. Some of the best teaching that I have heard here and the best preaching has helped me ask deep theological questions about the crucifixion of the land that occurred, about what extraction from creation means, what commodification of a gift means, and looking at it then through the lens of scripture and tradition and the crucified, suffering God, what is that story we will tell? So I look forward to the teaching and the preaching and the thinking that arises in human community that's reflecting on the relationship between humankind, the rest of creation, and a God who comes and suffers with us and with the land
and with the universe in some way. So that's another kind of storytelling that that I long for, another way to tell the story of what's happened.
I appreciate that, because I've used a lot of language such as us and I and them and we. And I think it's important to, in the end, remember that it is one, we, and that this isn't just a Rio Tinto or Holden Village or that robin or that grizzly bear or that macroinvertebrate. It's us.
You've done a beautiful job with this.
Thank you. Thanks.